Training to become a surgeon can feel like training for the Olympics. Then we finish and we realize we're just adults with jobs. Life after training is an entirely different landscape. You need to get to know you. What does success mean for you? What brings you joy? What's your purpose? I'm Dr. Mel Thacker, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and coach. I'm here to help surgeons like you rediscover themselves. Welcome to Surgeons with Purpose. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. I have a really exciting guest today. I am going to be interviewing Brad Stolberg. He is a coach. He is a writer. He researches and writes about mental health, mastery, meaning, and excellence. And he wrote two books. One, I'm halfway through, The Practice of Groundedness. And the other I found so useful, called The Master of Change. Definitely read both of those. They are full of gems. He contributes to the New York Times. His work has been featured in The Atlantic and The Wall Street Journal. And he's the co-founder of Growth Equation, a newsletter and platform for art, science, and achieving excellence. And I will leave links for his Instagram, his website, and his newsletter in the show notes. So thank you so much for joining me, Brad.
Thanks for having me, Mel.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into writing and coaching.
It was definitely a pretty circuitous path. In some ways, it makes total sense, and in other ways, it doesn't make much sense at all. So growing up, I loved writing, and I loved athletics. I was captain of the varsity football team, and I was the editor of the school newspaper, which is a somewhat rare combination, all the way back to middle school. And I thought I was going to be a writer. I applied to all the prestigious journalism schools, and I didn't get in. So like most 17-year-olds, I said, all right, I guess I'm not going to be a writer. I ended up going and getting a degree in economics and psychology, and just kind of went off on a different path. I worked for a big consulting firm, but I was always doing some semblance of writing or storytelling. I was never the person building the financial model in Excel. I was always the person writing the white paper. And this coincided with what I'm going to call like internet 1.0 in the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. So before social media, when WordPress or Blogspot was the way that you communicated on the internet. And if you were so inclined, you had a blog. So I had a blog. Very few people read my blog. My readership was probably like under 10 people, at least at first, but it kept me in the habit of writing. And at the time I was getting really into endurance sports. So I was writing about my training. I started to see parallels between athletic performance and performance in the more traditional knowledge workplace. And I started writing about some of those parallels. And it was really, I mean, not even a side gig for the first 5, 6, 7 years. It was just a hobby. Mm-hmm. And I kept at it and I stayed really consistent because I enjoyed it. It was my own writing practice. And eventually a couple of things broke through. And I just kept saying yes to more and more opportunities to write. It led to paid writing gigs, and eventually some of those paid writing gigs did really well. And, you know, all the way up to writing my first book. And it was after my first book came out that, at the time I was living in the Bay Area and performance coaching, much like I caught the blog wave, I caught the performance coaching wave. So this is again, about 10 years ago in the Bay Area, coaching for non-athletes was a thing. It wasn't really the case in other parts of the country. You know, maybe if you needed a coach, like you were on a performance plan or you were being disciplined, so you need to work with a coach. But in Northern California, it was very much like, you're a high performer, you're going to work with a coach. So people read my work.
Yeah.
And they asked me if I do coaching. And at the time, I'm like, the only thing that I've ever coached was when I was in high school, I coached my younger brother who was then in middle school's baseball team. So no, I hadn't done coaching, but enough people asked me where I started doing it pro bono and just giving it a shot and exploring, well, what would it look like to coach in a context other than sport and to really just help people think through, wrestle with, and try to apply some of the things that I had been writing about. In kind of like the writing thing, it started off very much as like a hobby. And I just kept doing it and more people wanted it. And eventually I developed a small private coaching practice and that grew. And now those are really the two primary hats that I wear, first and foremost as a writer, and then I coach to the things that I write about.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's so funny how you say that, like the performance improvement plans. And I hear a lot about that, how coaching is almost like weaponized, or at least it was at one point. And yet that's such a skewed view of coaching, because coaching is essential. I mean, honestly, I think everyone needs a coach, especially surgeons, especially physicians. We, in our profession, essentially, we go through a trauma. We go through a period of training where it's militaristic and it's cult-like, and we have vertical hierarchies that are put on us. And we're all notoriously overachieving people pleasers who are really, really smart, but have lost touch with who we are and what we want, essentially our why. And then we go out in a world when we're done and everybody's like, good luck, like go out and be a surgeon or go out and be a doctor. And you're like, but wait, now what do I do? And what does that mean? At least for me, coaching was so essential. Is that the experience you've had with your clients?
It is. And I think that something like the practice of medicine and perhaps surgery in particular really lends itself to coaching.
Yeah.
Because you are on this never-ending path of mastery.
Yeah.
Where you are refining a skill set. You are refining the person that you are, the physician that you are, the surgeon that you are. And it's really hard to see yourself and your work objectively and clearly the longer that you've been doing it. And it's so helpful to have someone that is in your corner that can have a little bit more of an objective eye to keep you on the path and to keep you developing and to be there when you fail and to help bolster your resilience throughout that process. So to me, being a world-class surgeon is not that different than being a world-class sprinter or swimmer, right? Like, you're already pretty damn good. We're talking like the smallest little refinements. And sometimes you've got to run 2 years worth of experiments to figure out the thing that's going to make you a little bit better. And that's just so much easier to do with a skilled coach supporting you than to try to do alone.
Yeah. There's a quote in your book, The Practice of Groundedness, about how fear-based learning is only useful in the short term and it never works long term. And I think that's such a foundation of how we learn, is out of fear. It's like fear of complication, fear of making a mistake. We tell ourselves a story that as long as we just show up and do everything perfectly, and we're emotionless robots who never make mistakes, we'll be fine. And the reality is, we're humans and humans inevitably err, but we don't have anyone to kind of catch us when that happens and help us distance ourselves from our thoughts and kind of parse out, like, what are the circumstances? What are my thoughts about it? How do I want to feel about it? What do I want to do about it? What kind of result do I want to create? And then consciously and deliberately move forward. And having a coach is everything to get you there and to get you kind of out of that fear, all or nothing, black or white, like trauma brain.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I'm not a surgeon. I've never operated on someone. I've never had a body in between life and death on a table in front of me. So I can't imagine how hard it is. However, I've coached a handful of surgeons. One of my closest friends is a surgeon. And something that we talk about often, both, again, my clients and with this friend, is it's really hard to maintain your humanism while being a really good surgeon, because there's this fear that if you let too much humanity in and you realize, like, I'm cutting through a body on the table, for a lot of people, that can complicate your mental state to then do a good job as a technician. But if you push that so far down, then the whole pursuit becomes empty. Yeah. I think a big part of finding fulfillment, and this isn't just for surgery, this is for the practice of medicine broadly, is keeping enough of a distance or remove from your patients that you can operate as a great, rational, skilled technician, while at the same time realizing that arguably more than any other craft or profession, medicine is one that ought to be full of humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think about that a lot, and I'm still trying to grapple with it. And I use, you know, the concept of duality, and you've mentioned it in your books as well. And like one of the big dual concepts that is like in the forefront of my brain is the whole idea of having a human brain and a surgeon brain. And one impossibility would be to try to create 100% perfect surgical outcomes for every single patient. And so like that's one part where you're holding it and you're like, I'm going to try for that, knowing that that's an impossibility. And then the other part is knowing that when patients do have complications, because they will, or when we do make mistakes or misjudgments or errors, that we are going to show up in support of that patient as like essentially as a human being, right? To have compassion for self and for other. How can I hold myself in that in failure and be there for that patient? knowing that compassion is a limitless resource. That's the key, I really think, of having a human and a surgeon brain is my surgeon self wants to get 100% perfect results every single time. But then I have to like seamlessly move into human realm and be a human for myself and for my patient when I inevitably make a mistake.
Yeah, all the while, even more challenging is often the patient thinks that you're going to do great 100% of the time. And most patients can't grasp like probability and the fact that, you know, a 92% positive outcome still means 8 out of 100 cases might not go the exact way that you want it to. So I think often like you're placing an impossible expectation on yourself, and then you might be having that expectation placed on you by a patient. And it really creates a pretty harsh atmosphere to sustain excellence. Because we know that if you beat yourself up too hard every time you fail, eventually you just stop stepping in the arena.
Yeah.
Because why would you step into the arena fully if the cost of that potential failure is that you beat yourself up? So what does that look like? For some people, that means like literally they stop practicing the thing. It becomes mm-hmm. too much. For other people, they do it, but they do it in a way where they're kind of going through the motions. And this thing that y'all worked so hard, so much training for to be able to do becomes kind of this soulless robotic thing is a protective mechanism because you're scared to feel fully what could happen if things don't go right. And I think like so much of elite performance in anything is the vulnerability to care really freaking deeply about what you're doing. And with every inch of yourself to want it to go right, to want to have your best performance, whether that's swimming across a 100-meter pool, shooting a jump shot, throwing a javelin, beating the market as a trader, or having a great outcome as a surgeon. But when you care deeply and when you do that, you make yourself vulnerable because you don't always succeed. Sometimes you fail, and you've got to hold space for that too. Otherwise, again, the whole pursuit kind of becomes robotic and empty. And I think that's the biggest risk that high performers face is they might still perform really well, but because they're trying so hard to protect themselves from failure, it just becomes like this empty pursuit, which defeats the whole purpose of mastery and excellence.
Yeah. What would you say is like the biggest pain point that your surgeon or your physician clients come to you with, and also that your performance athlete clients come to you with?
So for surgeons in particular and physicians more broadly, I think it's like, you know, physician heal thyself. Getting so dedicated to the craft and to one's patients and often operating in systems that are far less than ideal, that their own physical and mental health goes to crap.
Yeah.
Because there's no time for it. It gets deprioritized to everything else. Even if there is time for it, the leftover, sometimes very real, like noting and charting, and sometimes just like the mental rumination about a case or a patient, like encroaches on life. I think that's probably the hardest or the biggest pain point. I mean, like, I'm not helping people become better at the technical parts of surgery. That would be insane. It would be a terrible idea for someone to come to me for that because I've never done it. I'm trying to help someone build a good foundation, so that then they have the right foundation when they show up and operate, and they also have the right mental skills to ride, you know, highs and lows. I think one of the most challenging client engagements I ever had was with a pediatric neurosurgeon in an area that's fairly underserved, where we spent a lot of time just talking about like what is a good life and trade-offs. And I think that like there was a lot of self-judgment on this one particular person's case where, you know, not good enough for family, not good enough for community, not good enough for friends. But without this person, like many kids would not be getting the care they need. And often cases, many kids would not be like continuing to live.
Yeah.
And just like being really honest about those trade-offs and how do you balance these competing demands as best as possible so that when you look at yourself in the mirror, you feel good about what you're doing. I coach a handful of orthopedic surgeons. I think with them in particular, the biggest pain point is just like responding to cases that don't go as well as you think. And this is so similar to an athlete where once you've had that game where you're locked in and you know you can do it, you're like, I just want every game to feel this way. You know, like once you repair the ligament or the tendon or whatever it is, and like the case is just freaking perfect, it's very easy to be like, well, now everything should be like this. And then it's just not. And how, like you said, how do you bounce back from those suboptimal cases? Oftentimes, by the way, are completely fine. Like the patient doesn't even need a revision. Or if they do need a revision, then the ultimate outcome's okay. But just like really freaking hard on yourself, forgetting about the other 96 out of 100 cases that went pretty well.
Yeah. And we just kind of beat ourselves up. And it's like, there's such a waiting period between doing the thing and seeing the final result that like, there is all this space where we, if things don't go perfectly, or the patient has complications, we fill the time up with like rumination. It's like past, future, no presence. We're just like, let me just go over and try to think everything through. Let me go over the case and try to like change it almost by like running it through my mind. And let me think of every possible scenario in the future so that I can be prepared for it. And so we cause all this suffering for ourselves in that waiting period.
Yeah. Instead of like just learning what you can, and by no means is this a case for being delusional or ignoring errors or opportunities to get better, but it's like, all right, this happened. Here's what I'm taking from it. And now it's back to work. And back to the thing in front of you. And again, I think this comes down to expectations, which is being realistic with yourself that like, yes, you are constantly striving for excellence, but a part of the path to excellence and mastery is failure. Like there's always acute failure on the way to chronic gain. Yeah. And once you have that expectation, then when the failures come, you don't ignore them. You don't write them off, but you don't freak out as much about them either. Like you meet them in the moment, you handle them as best as you can, and then you get back on the path and you move on. And then if it's a repeated failure, well, then if you're interested in mastery, like you take steps to address it. And that like sounds so easy and so rational, but of course it's much easier to say than it is to do.
Yeah, it's all about the implementation. Where do you see the biggest hurdles in like implementing what they learn with coaching with you?
I mean, it's like any behavior change, right? Trying to do too much too soon, I think, is one of the biggest hurdles, or like prioritizing intensity over consistency. Something that I try to do with all my clients that are physically able is help them develop a movement practice. We just know that if you want to improve your physical health, your mental health, your social health, your ability to focus, like the number one modifiable lifestyle behavior that we can get people to do is physical activity. Hmm. And this doesn't mean you have to crush yourself at the gym or train for a marathon. This can mean you invest in a decent treadmill and you walk up a hill for 30 minutes every morning. However, that very quickly becomes, well, I need to train for a marathon, and then you feel great picking this big goal. You do it for 3 weeks and then you burn out. So it's kind of like, actually, no, like what you need to do is consistently walk up a hill on a treadmill in your basement. So the whole thing takes 32 minutes. And like, let's do that for 3 months before we start moving to, you know, maybe the next level of physical activity. So I think just like starting small, picking one or two things to work on, and then focusing on consistency over intensity as you make these lifestyle changes. I think something else that is an implementation challenge, again, particularly with physicians, is trying to simplify practice. Mm. And something that I hear a lot is there's just such a rush throughout the day because you're seeing so many patients. And a question I always ask is like, does it have to be like this?
Yeah.
And I'm surprised by how often the answer is no. It's like, well, why do you see 32 patients a day? Well, it's just like how my scheduler books me.
Yeah.
Well, who controls your scheduler? Like the office manager. Well, who's the boss of the office manager? Well, actually, I kind of am as a partner.
Yeah.
Well, what would happen if you see 26 patients a day? Well, access would go down. Well, you know, you're fixing people's ankles, and yeah, like you break your ankle, you want surgery, but is it that big of a deal if someone has to wait a week, if that means you don't burn out? And just getting someone from 32 patients a day to 26 patients a day or 28, and then just having that hour that then still gets spaced out along the day, but then you're not always running behind. You're not always stressed. If someone needs 24 minutes with you instead of 20, you can give them that 24 minutes. But making that initial cut back feels like so hard. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. Like there's so much anxiety about it.
Yeah.
And then 2 months later, it's like, oh my God, why haven't I had a schedule of 26 patients for the last 10 years? Yeah. No one's burning down the door saying the access sucks. So it's making those initial changes and then staying consistent, which again is just, that's just behavior change. Humans are human.
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that because like it could be that simple. And it's like, how could I have gone all these years without doing that when it's that simple, just cutting down my day from like 30 to 25? But there is also the piece of how you arrive at a place is how you are there. And so I think a lot of us are used to hustle culture and it's familiar. And we go through training and we have familiarized and essentially automated denying our needs for the needs of others. It's like toxic martyrdom and never stopping, not having any time to just take a breath.
That's
And,
right.
right. And so we've normalized it. And so now we're like, I have to create that because once the structure goes away after training is done, now we need to fill in the space. It's like we can't sit alone in a room and just be. That is like the ultimate thing is just like being okay with the unfamiliarity of a slower pace. And then
That's right.
right, baby stepping your way into that. You're like, just go down five patients. And I see so many clients say, like, oh, well, I'm leaving money on the table or whatever, or I'm not serving a community. Their brain will come up with all kinds of excuses. The access is going to go down. It's not even for the access, it's just so they hold on to that familiar hustle, that feeling. Isn't that just so fascinating that you're noticing?
Yeah, there's so many layers to this, and I think about this a lot, and this is a big part of the practice of groundedness, but also master of change is essentially, yes, we can get addicted to speed and hustle. And I think what also doesn't help is there's a very clear section of the bookstore that is hustle, hustle, push, 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 go, 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 discipline over everything. Navy SEALs giving you a hype speech, telling you, lean into the pain, make it hurt. And then there's a section of the bookstore telling you self-care, hold hands, sing kumbaya, perfect balance in life. And no one that made it through residency and fellowship as a surgeon is gonna find much reprieve in let's hold hands and sing kumbaya. Y'all just aren't wired that way, and that's fine. But I think both of those things are kind of grifts.
Yeah.
Because, like, true elite performance requires that you abandon perfect balance, that you make trade-offs and you prioritize, that you go all in on the things that you care about, but you have to do it in a way that's sustainable. There's a big difference between being world-class at quantity and suffering and making yourself miserable and being a world-class performer. And, the most popular person in this space is the former Navy SEAL David Goggins. Like, everyone knows Goggins, super motivational, gives a great hype speech. Goggins is world class at voluntary suffering.
Yeah.
But you look at his performance, he hasn't won shit. He's not a world class athlete. He's world class at suffering and giving hype speeches. And I think we so often confuse being world class at suffering with being a world class performer. Whereas you look at people who are actually world class performers and they have figured out how to go between stress and rest. How to push really hard and renew, how to figure out what parts of their life they need to hold on to have enough of a foundation to then be able to show up and perform, not just for 2 years, 3 years, but for a career. And I think once you get really curious about that, to me, that's like where the fun starts. Like, I am on this path of mastery. I want to be a world-class surgeon. Here's what that means to me. I know I'm not going to be quote unquote normal. I'm not working a 9 to 5, like, my accountant neighbor. I'm never going to have that person's life. But there's a way to do this where I don't burn out. And that starts with saying, I want to focus on excellence or performance, not I just want to suffer for the sake of suffering. And you use the word martyrdom, like, you don't, the goal isn't to be a martyr, the goal is to be a great surgeon. And those are very different things.
Yeah. I mean, you're touching on so much because it's so funny that you talk about David Goggins and how, what's the result he wants to create is ultimately the question for him. And if it's to write a book and to give a hype speech, then great, he's done that. But we have to ask ourselves that question, right? Like, what are you trying to create? Are you trying to burn yourself out and not have a sustainable life? Now, what's the access going to be for your community if that happens? And so it's like we forget what the result is because we just get so focused on putting our nose to the grindstone and just doing the job that we lose sight. It's like we need to zoom out a little bit.
Here's a really helpful framework to get to bounce between kind of philosophical and the world of ideas and concrete. Something that can be helpful is to define areas of your life that you feel are important to you that support you as being a good physician or a good surgeon. So examples could be sleep, physical activity, nutrition, community involvement, relationships, parenting, so on and so forth. And then to define a minimum effective dose. So what's the bare minimum I need to pay attention to preparing food? What's the minimum effective dose for exercise? For me, it's like 30 minutes a day. I think it's almost mandatory. What's the minimum effective dose of family time? Is it, I make sure that I have family dinners 3 nights a week. I'm not at meetings. It's going to look different for every person. But defining, like, here are the important rooms of my identity house, or these are the important parts of who I am as a person. And I know that there are going to be times when I have to deprioritize some of those things, but I can never go below this minimum effective dose, because when I do, I get myself into trouble. And what's nice is once you've defined those minimum effective doses, then you can kind of look at your practice and be like, great, as long as I'm meeting these minimum effective doses, I can go all in on being a surgeon.
Yeah.
And there are different seasons of life too. Like, it's going to look very different if you're parenting a newborn than if your kids are off in college.
Yeah. I love that. And I got the whole idea of a house from you. You know, what you're saying is, like, essentially minimum effective dosing is like, leave your surgeon bunker. I think of us like we're in this bunker with these really thick walls and we're like, we're stuck here. And you're basically saying like, no, just leave it. There's a door, open the door, go upstairs and like shine a light in the exercise room for like 10 minutes or 30 minutes. Like, go into like the sleep room and like, okay, you need like 6 or 7 hours, you know, go in the family room and whatever it is that will make you feel well resourced or like rejuvenate you in some way. But I think so many of us surgeons, we get so siloed in our worlds and we get so focused on the one goal of just achieving the thing of finishing training that we forget that we have like this whole other part of our identity. We've just lost touch with it.
Yeah. And I think that coming back to it is so important. And even if, and maybe there are some listeners that feel this way, even if you feel like you were put here on this planet to just do surgery, not to be a spouse, not to be a parent, not to be healthy, you know, all you cared about, this hypothetical person, is being a great surgeon, I would still tell you that to be a great surgeon, you should have some kind of social engagement in your life. You should have some kind of physical activity. You should make sure you're sleeping 7 hours a night, is bare minimums. And even if all you cared about is surgical performance, you'd still want to do those things. Because again, I think part of being an excellent surgeon is holding on to your humanity and being resilient to failure. And you're only going to hold on to your humanity and being resilient to failure if you yourself maintain your humanity and, like, you know, continue to be a human in the world. And I'm speaking in extremes, but I think that it's helpful to sometimes speak in those extremes to make clear, like, you know, these are like false trade-offs.
Yeah.
You know, at a certain point, like, sleep is the most productive thing you can do for your practice.
What is the biggest resistance you see with surgeons in terms of what you recommend for them?
I think it is the access will suffer, or dollars will suffer, or my partners will get mad at me. And then my job is to help someone figure out how much of that is real or a story they're telling themselves.
Mm.
And sometimes that can just be ego.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you see this sometimes too, if, like, later in their career, physicians, you know, my kids really want me to come visit for the weekend and they live 2 hours away and I'd have to take Fridays at a clinic and blah, blah, blah. And no one else can do it. It's like, really? You know, like, what about all the people that you trained? They can't do it. And then it's like being clear, well, is it that they can't do it, or that you think you're better, or is it that you just want to do it and, like, you're not ready to let go of this? And that's okay too. Like, I am so values agnostic, right? Like, if you're not breaking the law or harming yourself, like, is someone that reads my books, I want them to take what is there in my books and help themselves. But I think that starts with, as you kind of said, being clear on what you want.
Yeah.
And if what you want is to devote your life to medical practice or devote a stage of your life to it, yeah, let's talk about how you can get the most out of yourself doing it. But then, like, be honest with yourself and say, hey, I'm okay. Like, you know, this neurosurgeon, a big part of it was like, I am never going to be the romantic partner and parent that I think I want to be. And that is painful and that hurts me, but I'm consciously making this choice because I want to be the pediatric neurosurgeon that I feel like I can be. And as long as we're evaluating that a couple times a year and staying true, and that's true, that's fine. And at some point, it's going to change for this person, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
but like I'm values neutral. And some other people might say the exact opposite, which is I want to be the parent in the significant other. And who am I to judge? Because I'll tell you what, if it's my kid on the table, I'm really glad that that person has built their life around being the best pediatric neurosurgeon. So like, there's nothing wrong with that. There's only problems when we lie to ourselves and we face cognitive dissonance. And eventually this stuff creeps up and burns us.
Yeah. And it's, you're right. They're like, there is no judgment as like a coach. That's wonderful. When you're just like, what do you want to create? And it may change, like you may evolve beyond that. And I think that's also something that we don't realize is like, we think life is linear. We just go up and up and up. And it's like achieve, like climb the mountain. And then you just sit up on top and enjoy all of the fruits of your labor. And you get all of this power, status, and wealth and meaning and purpose, because we all got into this to like help people. And we're like, okay, but now I'm not happy. And why? And it's because we've just achieved one thing. We've closed one loop. We've climbed one mountain. And now it's like, we didn't realize like that wasn't the end. Life doesn't end there. Now you have to give yourself freedom to evolve and find a new goal. Like,
yes.
What's the next result you want to create?
Yeah. Right? I have this hypothesis of physician burnout.
Yeah.
And, you could tell me maybe if anecdotally you've seen this too, and it would be fascinating to try to like, figure out some rigorous methods to test this. But ultimately I think like there's two causes of physician burnout that everyone talks about. And then there's a third that I think is not discussed. So the two that everyone talks about that are both real is one is just sheer amount of volume of work beyond someone's capacity for work. You know, if you're taking call 5 days a week, you're working 16, 18 hour days, you're not sleeping, like eventually the system just says, I'm done. Mm-hmm. That's real. Something else is the loss of like autonomy and belonging. In some cases, even mastery. I think surgeons, what's really nice is like mastery is such a part of what you do. But for non-surgical physicians, like the more that care gets algorithmic, mm-hmm. like the more it kind of takes away from that sense of creativity and mastery.
Yeah.
So if autonomy, mastery, or belonging start to suffer, then burnout usually follows. And I think that like these things are being, at least they're named and hopefully they're being addressed. But I think a third cause of burnout is you see it in like the 45 to 55 year old physician who essentially has done everything that you've just said. Mm-hmm. They got great grades in high school, so they got to the best college. They did great in pre-med, so they got to the good med school. They did great in med school, so they got the residency. They did great in residency, so they got the fellowship. They were a great attending, so they were made a assistant chief. They were great as an assistant chief, so now they're a chief. They were great as a chief, so now they're chair of the department. And now suddenly you're 45 and you're 50 and you're like, what's the next thing? And there is no next thing. Like, that's it. You're the chair. And for all of this hard work, you have six meetings between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. a week. And I say that kind of facetiously. There's a lot of amazing leadership that comes with being a chair. But I think a part of burnout is like, if you get so latched on to needing to achieve the next rung on the ladder, well, you get to the top of the ladder and you're 45 and you're like, well, now what?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that contributes to like emptiness and loss of meaning and questioning one's purpose. And to me, this is why it's so important to find fulfillment in the process of pursuing mastery, not the result, mm-hmm. because the result is short-lived and you're not going to be content. Like you think you're going to be content. I mean, everyone listening to this podcast, how many times do you say, if I just get this residency, I'll be content. If I just get this fellowship, I'll be satisfied. You know, if I just have this volume and like this patient experience or whatever outcomes measure, then I'll tell myself I'm a good surgeon. And my guess is it lasts like somewhere between an hour and a week of you feeling good. And then you're like, what's the next thing?
Yeah.
And that's really hard to reverse. Like that's our nature. Like humans evolve to strive. We're a striving species. If we weren't, we wouldn't have been selected to advance this far as a species. So it's not that we shouldn't strive, but we've got to learn to find satisfaction in the process, not just the outcome. Because if it's only in the outcome, we're never going to be happy because there's always like more. And eventually you reach the top of the ladder and you're like, now what?
Yeah. It's Albert Camus' One Must Imagine Sisyphus Happy, right? Sisyphus,
yeah.
Pushing the boulder up the thing. Like it is all about the pushing of the boulder up the mountain. There is no stopping in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you use that. The current draft of my next book, I end using like the myth of Sisyphus and that interpretation. Yeah. I love it that like life is just like, that's what we're doing. Like we're just pushing boulders up a hill and you get to the top of the hill and then there's another boulder to push. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what Camus said is like, if you can learn to do it with a smile, you've won the game essentially.
Right.
And like that's the goal here is like to find satisfaction in the process of trying to be great because it doesn't live in the outcome.
Yeah. And it's like, it not to be like grandiose or like I have the meaning of life or anything or that we do, but like after 44 years of living, I'm like, oh my gosh, like the striving is the whole point. It is like the effort is where it's at. Like I didn't realize that. I think back now that my career has shifted where I am leaving a private practice. I've been a surgeon for 12 years and I'm at the top of my game in terms of my performance. I love my ORs. I'm working efficiently. My skills are so good. My muscle memory is so good. And I told my husband, I'm like, I feel like I'm going out like Seinfeld. Like I'm now evolving into like a coach. And I'm remembering what it was like in med school where I could use like my creativity and I had my own schedule and I was filling my brain with knowledge. And I was like, how fun was it when I had this effort? Like, I almost feel like I finished Surgeon Mountain and I'm just sitting at the top and I'm like, oh, this is like boring. But now I have this whole other thing and like the striving, the feeling of the striving is coming in and it feels so good. And I think we forget that and we think we just need to get to the end of it, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'd be curious to also like explore again, like in the spirit of being values neutral and non-judgmental. I think some of this is probably individual temperament because I think some people probably get to where you are and they're like, great. Like now we're talking like the equivalent of a sprinter getting one thousandth of a second better, where no one's going to notice but that sprinter. And is that what lights you up? Or is what lights you up actually going down 2 days in clinic to do mentoring or coaching? And you know, you cut your volume to a point where you're still on your freaking game, but you start to develop another tool in your toolkit as a physician. Maybe that's administrative leadership. Maybe it's coaching. Maybe it's mentoring. Maybe it's you've been grinding so hard that you're like, you know what? I'm going down to 7/10 because I want to learn how to deadlift or I want to learn how to do watercolor painting. And that's okay too. And it just starts with like being really clear about what you want. I think.
Yeah, and that's what like you talk about diversifying yourself, right? You have
Yes.
to diversify. You have to diversify your identity like you do your portfolio.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then I think that also, particularly for some subspecialties, it's back to the expectation that if you're going to get really good and do a really high volume and be really efficient, depending on the subspecialty, like you are probably going to have to figure out new things to keep your curiosity flowing. Like if you are a joint replacement surgeon that does one joint, are there going to be cases that present challenges? 100%. But once you've mastered that joint, I don't want to use the word boring. That's a pretty filled with negative connotation, but like it might get a little bit boring. And then the question becomes, okay, well, can you get deeper and deeper into trying to do it better? Or if you feel like you've reached the top of that mountain, well, then how do you, what else is going to fill you with that creativity and the challenge and the generativity?
And I mean, that's where you get into just like finding your purpose. You're like, well, what am I here for then? We almost forget. I feel like I see this as a very common thing. Like, we remember that idealistic 18-year-old or however old we were, where we were like, oh, I'm going to do that. And we romanticize what it's like. And then when we actually go through the decade of training, decade and a half of training to get there, that goal of that 18-year-old has completely changed. In fact, that person has completely changed because every 7 years we like change over our cells. Like the only cells that are actually still in our body that are from that person who made that decision are our stem cells. But everything else is different. Everything else is a whole new human being. But we've never taken the time. And that's why I think coaching with like someone like you is so amazing to just kind of like get very clear on the why, on why are we doing what we do? We can say what we do, we can say how we do it, but why are we doing it? Like, why are we doing pediatric neurosurgery? Why are we fixing a joint? Like, why do we want to do that?
Yeah. And also like you get to that point and then maybe the challenge becomes, I want my OR culture to be phenomenal. I want to inspire every orderly to eventually be a surgeon. And for the next 3 years, that's what I'm going to focus on is how can I be an inspiration to everyone around me? Because I feel like my technical skill is like as good as it's going to get right now. That's what it is for some people. For other people, it's like, you know, I'm gonna go down a day a week and I'm gonna start coaching or mentoring. And all of those are fine answers. It's just being clear on what you want. And again, I think it's specialty specific, right? Because like a general sports surgeon probably doesn't face this problem because they're doing all kinds of different cases all the time.
Yeah. And they're going everywhere. They're like traveling around with like sports teams and getting to like watch on the sidelines, and they get all that, get to like scratch that itch of being like a sports fan.
Yes, exactly. Although I know a couple of sports surgeons, and it's a lot of like high school games and, the
Okay.
middle of nowhere too. But yes.
I'm thinking of like Patriots surgeons or things like that, but
Yeah, they're on call all the time though, and those are tough patients.
oh, absolutely. The VIP patients.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you see in like performance athletics that translates best into like the operating room or like the those like high stress environments that would be relevant for surgeons?
The people around you are so important.
Okay.
So developing a supportive community,
Yeah.
a team, a culture, an organization where you have each other's backs and you can be really vulnerable with each other, and you all care deeply and you're all focused on the same goal. We underestimate how big of an impact the people around us have on us at all times. That's one thing. Something else is trying to create the conditions to get completely absorbed in what you're doing, like a flow state, right? So, how can you be really present for what you're doing? How can you try to enter the competitive arena or the OR, giving yourself the best chance to settle into like that fully absorbed state where like there is no you and no patient, surgery is just happening.
You lose
Like the
yourself, right?
Yes, the best moments are like, I'm not doing surgery, surgery is happening. Like I'm just like a part of this like universal dance and it's just happening. And all the while also knowing that it's not going to be like that every time. And I think that we run a risk both in sport and in surgery in over-focusing on that and being like, oh, I need to get into the zone. When in fact, there's another performance state, which is called a clutch state, which is when we're not in flow and it's tedious and we're grinding. And it's uncomfortable, and we're having intrusive thoughts, and we're making errors, but we stay in it and we still win the game or we still get the good outcome. And to an outside observer, you scored 100 points or you repaired the ligament or the tendon or whatever, or the blood vessel, the artery. So to them, it's the same. Like you won the game. And part of being a pro is being able to, yes, get into flow and obviously have those great moments, but to get a comparable outcome even when it's tedious. And I think that is such a part of what separates great performers from not so great performers. And anyone can do well on their best day when they get into the zone. But when you're not in the zone, can you stay in it and can you stay focused and can you continue to begin again? And even if it feels just terrible, can you still get an acceptable outcome? I think that like that is so important.
Yeah, that's the ultimate of like being able to create the same result, whether you're in a high value cycle or a low value cycle. You're like, maybe it'll be a little clunky and when I'm outside of flow, when I'm not in the vortex, but yeah, but I still create the same result. Like that's amazing.
Yeah, and can you not fall apart in those
And
moments?
not shame yourself,
So
not live
like,
on the shame and the blame. Like,
yeah, when you're in that moment, can you be like, all right, and this is
all
something
right.
I talked about recently with an orthopedic surgeon client of mine. It's like when you're in those moments, can you just acknowledge it and accept it and be like, I don't feel good today. This isn't going well. My hands are a bit shakier. Like I'm off my game. And all right, like this is what's happening. I'm off my game. Like let's still perform really well even when I'm off my game. And it might not be the most enjoyable day. There might be a little bit more anxiety in the background, but like I can still perform well when I'm not at my best. And great athletes do that too. I call it raising the floor, right? So there's raising the ceiling, which is like your peak performance, but every bit as important is raising the floor.
Wow, awesome.
And then I think one other conceptual tool that I think is useful is just this notion of like stress plus rest equals growth. And if you don't have rest and renewal, like you're gonna stop growing, you're gonna stop getting better. For an athlete, it's overtraining syndrome. For a physician, it's burnout. But in order to have sustainable excellence, you've got to figure out the balance of stress and challenge, and then rest, renewal, and reflection.
Yeah, and isn't that so funny how we tell ourselves that we're a superhuman as if like we don't need the rest, but we're not exempt. And then the other question I would have for you, because like you brought up how you have to have a culture, you have to be kind of like the captain of the ship, but you have to have a team that supports you. And like the burning question, I think for a lot of us is how, because what we've been modeled is that everyone's terrified. We have a surgeon who is throwing instruments. I mean, recently in the news, there was a surgeon who took out a liver instead of a spleen. The people who were there assisting him could see. And in fact, I read the report on that. I think the nurse in the room like started to dry heave or started to want to throw up because she was afraid to say something. And of course, the patient ultimately died. It's like, how do you create that culture where everyone around you feels psychologically safe to just speak up and not step on the surgeon's ego?
I think that every generation says that this is a like an artifact of training. And at some point, you have to be the generation, and maybe that's our generation, that just swallows it and says, yep, this is how it was, and I am swallowing it, and it's stopping with me. And what does that mean? It means when you go into the OR, you're like, hey, y'all, I've trained a lot, but I am just a human, and I'm as skilled as anyone there is, but I'm fallible, and I'm working with you, and there are things that I can do better than you, and there are probably things that you can do better than me, but in this environment, we're a team. And if I start to fuck up, let me know. And everyone's hearing this. And if I fuck up and you let me know and I snap at you, then let me know that I snapped at you. And like, I need to do better. But at some point, like some generation is just going to have to like swallow it and be like, this is unacceptable. This is not a high performance culture. This is a culture of fear. And it's like a machismo culture. And everybody suffers as a result of it. And I don't think that it has to be that way. In sport, this shift is starting to happen where like the Bobby Knight authoritarian coach, like there's enough research that shows now that like he doesn't win because he's Bobby Knight. He wins in spite of it. And he probably would have won a lot more if he wasn't such an asshole.
Yeah.
And I think that more and more you're seeing that the best high performance cultures in sport have a ton of what I will call like badass characteristics, but there's also a lot of love and kindness. And I think that that shift needs to happen in medicine too, where, yeah, what you're doing is really hard. And yeah, the hours are uncomfortable and the stress is high and all of that is true. And you have to be a badass to be able to do it. But you've also got to learn to be kind to yourself and kind to others and have fun. Because if you can't do the latter, then the former is just not going to be sustainable.
Yeah, it's like a thought error that like in order to perform well or to like do a good surgery, you have to be the asshole because it's like, but that's what's been modeled. And it's not true. I've attached in our brains good surgeon with asshole. And we have to kind of detach that. Pilots get this kind of training. Like there is a lot of leadership training where they have to create a culture of safety so that the flight attendants can speak up. And yet we get none of that. I don't think it's going to be easy. I agree with you. I think it has to change and it has to start with us. And it has to be come from a place of compassion for where our mentors came from because they came from the same training as they're trying to give us. It's almost like a vicious cycle that's repeating itself, but it has to stop somewhere. And we can do that while having compassion for them, even if they're not like the ideal model, and doing it differently and having compassion for ourselves when we fail and we like lash out in the OR or old patterns start to seep in. Cause I think it's going to be really slow, like turning a ship, just one little turn at a time. And eventually you end up at a completely different destination, like years or months down the road. But I think you're completely right. Like it needs to start and there needs to be a culture shift, but I think it's going to be really slow.
Yeah. And I think that for the longest time, we didn't even have like the vocabulary for
right.
it. And that's a big part of what I'm trying to do in my books, not just for surgeons and in medicine, but more broadly is again, like you've got like the badass Navy SEAL machismo, like performative toughness, I'll call it. And then you've got the let's all hold hands and sing kumbaya. But like there hasn't been a framework or a vocabulary for like the middle, which is, I think, like where genuine excellence lives.
Yeah.
You see this in sport all the time. Like the documentary gets made about Michael Jordan, who is a psychopath in many ways. But what you don't get is the Tim Duncan documentary or the Katie Ledecky documentary. I mean, there are other ways to do it, but we're attracted to like the crazy train wreck. Because that's what makes for like an entertaining documentary, but there are multiple different ways to win. And the research shows that like you win more if you can learn to find joy and compassion and love at the same time that you're a badass and you're pushing yourself. And I just think like that's on you. It's on your listeners. It's on people who are leading in whatever fields they're in to be able to embrace that duality and to role model it, and then just to like swallow all the bullshit that might have come before you, but not throw the baby out with the bathwater and realize, like, to be a highly skilled surgeon, you do have to be able to turn it on, and you can't get rid of that intensity because that intensity makes you who you are, but you've got to learn how to hold like joy and camaraderie and love at the same time as the intensity.
Yeah, it's not all or none. Like, there is this middle ground, and like, you go really deep into the nitty gritty of how to do that and give a lot of language for it. You have so many pearls and gems in your books. So we're coming to an end, but what would you say is, like, if you could give your physician clients one piece of advice, what would that be?
You're not trying to be champion of the day or the week. You're trying to be champion of the decade or of a career. And what are the systems and habits that are going to get you to that point? Because anyone can crush themselves and be champion of the day. It's not hard. It's really hard to sustain excellence for years and for decades. And you want to be remembered not for any single day of work, but for a body of work. So how do you create the conditions to allow yourself to produce the best body of work?
Love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So many great pearls in that conversation. Brad Stahlberg is incredible. His books have been instrumental for me. I highly recommend that you check them out, Master of Change and The Practice of Groundedness. He is also a coach for high performance athletes, and he works with many physicians. I will leave a link in the show notes on how to work with him. He takes clients and does a 1-year membership program, but you are absolutely able to work with him if that's something that you would want to do. As I say, every surgeon needs a coach. I will see you all next week, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Bye. Hey, when you got into surgery, when you were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you told yourself a story that it was going to be amazing, and it's not. That's okay. If you want to learn how to navigate the landscape of life after training, you are in luck. I have created a course just for you. It's called Empowered Surgeons Curriculum. It gives you everything you need to learn that you didn't learn in training about how to be a human in the world of surgery. All you have to do is go to courses.melthackercoaching.com/courses/empowered surgeon or click the link in the show notes. See you inside the course.